Are you ready? I am ready.
I'm ready. Yeah.
Okay,
Yeah.
fantastic. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. Today we have Dr. Karen Jean Martinson, who is an assistant professor in the program of Communications, Media Arts, and Theater at Chicago State University. And her bio says currently a professor there because she's going to make a move to Arizona pretty soon, but I'll let her talk about that. And she is a super fancy doctor. And the thing we're going to talk about today is the dramaturgy of tiki culture, which is also very fancy. She is a scholar of Elvez, the Mexican Elvis slash otherwise known as Robert Lopez. And she's great. She's super cool, way cooler than most people whose names start with doctor, in my opinion. Like, I just know, like, compared to, say, my rheumatologist, you have a lot less terrible, like, man jewelry that you think is really hip to go with your lab coat. So that's my introduction of Dr. Karen Jean Martinson. Karen, tell me how you got to be a doctor of super cool pop culture things.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm really excited to be
Thanks for
here.
being here.
Yay! And it's very nice to be called super cool doctor. Most of my students don't ever say that, so
Oh
thank
yeah,
you.
well, then your students just aren't cool enough to know what's
They're
cool
just
yet.
like, Martinson. So I got into pop culture almost by accident, honestly. So here's my is a very long educational journey made short. I started as an English major and a political science major as an undergrad because I love literature and then I love politics, right? So and then I was like, what to do with that? And I didn't know what I wanted to do with that. And I'd always loved seeing theater, but I'd never done it, or I tried to do it, but I'm really bad. I'm a terrible actress, right? So I had been I'm awful. Like, honestly, it's terrible. So I never considered doing theater in college or anything like that because it just was it didn't I didn't know my way into it, but I loved attending it. And then I was at a show and I saw in the program this thing called dramaturg, and I said, "What is that?" Right? It sounds interesting and
Oh, do you remember
amazing.
what show you were at?
It was something at the Guthrie Theater in
Oh,
Minnesota. I think it was Philadelphia, Here I Come, but I don't know. I might be making that part up, but I
But it was
liked
at the
that show.
Guthrie. I like
But it was
that.
definitely at the Guthrie. And then, the Guthrie obviously puts out great programs with tons of information. And I always loved reading that. And that's where I was like, prepared by Faye Price, the dramaturg. What? Who's that? What
What?
is this? Right? And that's how I realized I could use the skills that I had, but actually put them. Like, I was afraid of going into graduate school and writing papers for other people who read these papers, but not really interfacing with the public. So dramaturgy obviously gets us in there and allows us to use these skills, like these research skills, these critical thinking skills. But you have to talk to a diverse public, and I love that. So that's how I got on the theater road, right? And so as soon as I entered theater, it was like, I'm going to be a dramaturg. And I didn't even know. That's me now, right? So I'm doing that. And then as I was going through my grad school, I knew I wanted to talk about issues of race and class and gender and sexuality and these like divisions in our society because it's really drawing on the political work that I do. And I do a lot of socially engaged kind of theater and do a lot of devising for social justice causes and stuff like that. So I knew I wanted to work with that. And then one Christmas at the end of finals, I decided to go see Elvez because he came through Minneapolis every year. And I just went as a joke. I thought it was going to be just a stupid lark. And I went there and I was immediately in love with what he does because he's doing all these things that I do, but he does it in this really fun way of a rock show. And social justice doesn't have to be like a big bummer all the time. It can be really uproariously fun and engaging, and that's what he does. And so I just kind of kept writing about him. I couldn't get him out of my mind, and then he became a chapter of the dissertation. And then since getting my PhD, like I've really written almost exclusively about his performances and what he's doing, and I'm working on a book about him. And that's how I got into really this. I mean, I guess the inklings for pop culture were already there, but then my obsession with Elvez came in like the most serendipitous way of just like, I'm going to go cut loose and have fun. And holy shit, fun can be really smart.
I love everything about this. Okay. So I can see you. Our audience is audio only. But the last couple times that I've seen you, I've been really fascinated by like you've got like a super low key look right now, but you've got kind of like the little bit of that like tiki, like just a tiny bit of the tiki cat eye thing going.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm really like, I'm impressed that you're able to, when working from home, be able to make your, like, you've just got the look of a cool person. Like, you're basically who I want to be when I grow up. And well, I've never been able to figure out how to get my eyeshadow to do the thing.
Let me hope I can parlay that. Because when I was at the Tiki Oasis event, I just felt like the dumbest, ugliest person in the room, right? Because everybody there is so on point, right?
Yeah.
I was just like,
it's a level of precision.
I mean, I kind of thought it would like work in this as the professor, that I could be a little dorky and it would fit the image, right? But like, yeah, they are 1,000 times better than I am. And to be honest, I really don't normally comb my hair on Tuesdays because I don't go to campus. So I did all this for you.
Oh, bless your precious heart. I'm still in my pajamas and I haven't put on any makeup. But it's earlier here in Los Angeles than it is in Chicago. So I'm just going, like, I put in earrings and then I put on these headphones so you can't tell. But like, earrings are the difference between jammies and boho chic. So
yeah.
I'm boho chic for you this morning.
Thank you.
Yes, this is just, you know, just all totally frivolous, but it's also, I think, really important to the sort of the spirit of what we're talking about today, mm-hmm. because these pop culture visual cues, like this sort of like the eye makeup that lets people know that you are an insider, is it's a thing. I was going to say it's important, but I don't know if the eye makeup itself is important, but those visual cues of I'm an insider and who are you, is always something that strikes me with going to, I do enjoy myself a bit of tiki culture.
Yes.
and getting to these events, there is a little bit of a part of it is the fun of dressing up, but I'm not good at like that sort of performative femininity to an extent. Mm-hmm. Like I can do the makeup minimally. I don't know how to use a hair dryer. I like dresses and I can't walk in heels. So I come in kind of, you know, looking like a dramaturg.
Yeah, right.
Put on her favorite tiki dress.
Exactly. With a pencil stuck in your hair or something.
Yeah,
we don't know.
Exactly. I got it up. It's on top of my head where it's supposed to be. And there is a sense of who's doing it right, who knows, who's
sure.
in it to win it, who got the big old rollers for their hair and found the vintage hairspray to keep those big old juicy curls in there, and who's like a tourist.
Yeah,
I feel
totally.
Like a tourist to tiki culture as much as
I
enjoy
like
it.
A bigger tourist because I really don't. I gain entry to these places because of my relationship with Robert now, because I've been writing about him for 15 years. Robert Lopez slash Elvez, the Mexican Elvez.
Yes.
Right? So for 15 years, I've been writing about him. And over the course of that time, obviously, I've become friends with him and gotten to know him really well. And he evidently likes what I have to say because he keeps talking to me, right? he brings me to a lot of these events. So with him, I went to the Burlesque Hall of Fame. I went to this Tiki Oasis. I've gone to little like this thing in LA called Brookledge, which is like this indie art scene, magic castle-y related thing. It's like super shishi, right?
Brookledge, you say?
Brookledge, yes.
I'm gonna write that down.
It's very, you have to know somebody to get in, and it's in somebody's mansion in Hancock Park.
Yes.
It's just nutso. It's super cool. But I get access to these places. And one thing, you know, I sort of, along the way of working with Robert and becoming his really good friend and scholar, you know, I joke that I'm the doctor of Elvez, right? but along the way, I mean, I've realized he's an artist in his life, right? Like his life is a work of art in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. And he, it's almost like improv. Like I just, at a certain point, I'd like, whatever he says, I'm just saying yes to, right? Like whatever he offers, I'm going to do this. And because of that, I've been, you know, at weird like parties with a bunch of Cirque performers, and I've been at the Beehive, and I've been all these places, and it's been great. But I definitely, to go back to this, feel like an imposter oftentimes, because what I, you know, I like look at everybody and kind of mimic what they're doing to a certain extent, and adopt it because I like the cat I look myself.
Right.
But they come correct, and they are, you know, precise to such a level, both the burlesque community and the tiki community. And I'm like, well, I just have to look like I know enough, but I'm not trying to be one of them, right? So it is like, what is my performance going to look like here? You know, and it's really like kind of bringing that idea of performance into your everyday life. Okay, what can I perform? I can perform the professor who's cool, but not trying to appropriate because I haven't done that sort of work, right?
Right. Yeah, that is legit.
You know, and especially if I want to be heard by those people, I cannot look like it. Like, oh, now I'm Miss Tiki, right? Because I'm not that. So if I want them to listen to the message that I have to say and the information I want to share with them, I have to adopt my performance, right?
Yeah.
So that I'm somebody credible.
I'm picking up what you're laying down. something that I wonder as a professorial type, somebody who is an academic, do you have more of the introverted observer personality when you go to these big social events? And if so, is that difficult? Like, do you kind of feel like you're coming in as an anthropologist, like standing at the back, taking notes a lot of the time? Like, what socially, how is that for you?
Yeah, no, it's interesting because there's a little of that, and certainly more at Beehoff than Tiki Oasis. Because when I was at Beehive, I was totally observing. I didn't do any presenting or anything. So I have a couple friends who do burlesque, so they were there, fortunately. So I had those people to talk to or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I did feel very like outsidery observer, and like in fact, one guy, I bought tickets for one event from somebody via this whole crazy arrangement. But he was like, oh yeah, and by the way, what's your stage name? I'm like, Dr. Martinson.
Oh, that's great. Blended right in.
And not only that, the Beehive people are very comfortable with their bodies. And, you know, I mean, that's a whole part of it.
Beehive, burlesque
Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Cool.
So they are the Beehives, right? but they're very comfortable with their bodies and are just out there and in a way that I've never, you know, I'm just like,
button up higher.
Yeah.
Ooh, you've got someone at the door. Hey, let's take a quick break in recording.
Great. Sounds good. I'll be right back.
We'll be back after these messages.
It's my brother-in-law who's staying with us.
Hi, brother-in-law. And we're back after messages that I'm going to figure out what they are after the fact. And since we had a little pause, there is something that I want to ask you that I've been trying to be better about asking everybody on this show. Dr. Karen Jean Martinson, what is dramaturgy?
Oh, man.
I know. It's always the
I wasn't
hardest
ready for
question.
This one. This is a hard question.
It's the hardest pop quiz question.
Yeah, it is. How do I define dramaturgy? I mean, I primarily work as a production dramaturg. What am I? I sound like I've never done this before. Right?
It's okay. I think we're all kind of making it up as we go along.
Right. I primarily work as a production dramaturg. So I don't do a lot of new play dramaturgy. I don't do some of the other cool new emergent forms of dramaturgy. So I'm really just based in production. And I guess for me, dramaturgy is about being obviously rooted in the text and providing the research to support the director's concept, and then to use that research in both the production process, the rehearsal process, but also to reach out to the audience and give them a way in. I think theater should be complex and demanding and challenging, but we have to work with our audience to get there, right? So that they don't feel, an audience member shouldn't feel like they were supposed to have read the book before they got there.
Yeah.
Right? I should read the book and I should read lots of books and things and get that context, but it's also bridging to the different people that you're working with, right? Bridging to the artistic staff, the actors, bridging to the public. So I guess that's like in the most practical sense. Most of the work that I do, though, is much more community engaged. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's also finding the people whose stories need to be told and working with them to create the best way to share those stories to make this world nicer, better, and to affect positive change.
I love it. Yeah, thank you. And that was great. That was a really, really good, precise definition of like, of what a dramaturg actually does. So far, everybody that I've had on, and myself included, I've only one time acted as a production dramaturg. Mm-hmm. And I tend to live way more in the facilitating meaning making fringy dramaturgy world. And in fact, I consider doing this podcast itself a dramaturgical endeavor because it's
absolutely
like metaturgy.
For sure.
But
and I think, you know, in my scholarship too, I feel like I'm incredibly dramaturgical in the way, you know, I'm always working with the now, and working with present issues. And it's just like I really kind of follow what Jeff Prohl writes about is the dramaturgical sensibility, and that informs everything that I do and the way that I process everything that I encounter. So most of my articles and everything are really like looking at right this second.
Right. Like, why is this important right now?
Yeah. And then also trying to demonstrate in a similar way, like the critical theory that I embrace and I use and these ways of thinking about things aren't just for academics. It's for anybody. And I can be the bridge to put it in a kind of a regular, you know, to reach different audiences. And I think that's why I like writing about Alves so much, because he's doing that and he's quite dramaturgical in his performances, especially because he's working in a venue of rock performance that really is just, you know, like most people think of rock and go, oh, you get up on the stage and you sing songs. And he charts entire shows that have a sort of narrative to them. So he's doing this very dramaturgical work. And I sort of model, or I guess, well, I'm not modeling off of him, but I also think and do that way. And writing about him allows me to share this critical thinking and these critical theories with an audience through a really popular medium.
That is excellent. And just for the audience who what I anticipate is we're going to have listeners who are not dramaturgs, a lot more of the pop culture enthusiasts coming in. Oh yeah, I do too. I hope so. My sneaky aim with this podcast is to help people with hiring power in various creative forms know to look for the word dramaturg or dramaturgy on resumes when they're hiring for, like, I was going to say Disney Imagineering, but one of the main gals at Disney Imagineering is a former LMDA president, so she knows.
She gets it.
But everybody else out there. Yeah. So if they're not in this academic world, you mentioned Jeff Prohl, and he is at the University of Puget Sound. He's written some of the main textbooks that are sort of the go-to. He's a good person to Google. And he's very good, I've found, at sort of doing the dramaturgy of dramaturgy, where he's like, hey, friends, here's what dramaturgy is. Here's your way in, which I need. You know, speaking of that impostery feeling, because dramaturgy, the language of it is so draped in this academic veneer. I was doing it for years without even knowing that's what it was called. And that's something that's important to me as the VP of membership for literary managers and dramaturgs of the Americas, is I want to also be roping in people who are doing this work and feel like they don't have a community, because it felt like such an island for such a long time. Like, I work at this theater and I facilitate meaning making. If only there
Yeah.
was a word for it.
If only that thing was called something. Oh, wait, it is.
It is.
Well,
turns out.
One of the things I like in Jeff Prohl's book is that he also talks about, you know, he's really clear to say dramaturgs aren't defined by a list of tasks that they do. It is this way of thinking. And everybody who's involved in theater is doing dramaturgy in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. So he's not trying to have ownership over, you know, this is the dramaturg's domain. He's saying that dramaturgy is inherent to the theater process because it is about that meaning making, like you're saying, that we're doing that. And that can certainly happen outside of theater too,
right?
That we don't need the title to do the work, but the title does help us to identify, you know, what it is that we do, as long as we start sharing that with the greater world, right?
Right, exactly. I love it. I have a question for you about your area of specialization. Well, Elvis specifically, but this sort of retro pop culture aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Do you find that your work is somewhat geographically limited to the major metropolitan areas with old time?
Yeah. Are you there? Hold on.
I am.
Okay, great. I thought the audio popped out for a second. Okay, can you repeat the end of the question?
Yeah. So are you limited to doing work in these major metropolitan areas with old timey charm, like American mm-hmm. specifically? Because I don't. You were in Chicago. You have spent time in
yes.
Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I could see you doing well in a Vegas. and then are you sort of like, well, I can't go, like, my work can take me to places that have a saturation of at least three reputable tiki bars, or
I only go to places with reputable tiki bars.
Same.
No, I mean, it's interesting because just as a person, I enjoy being in cities. I definitely like urban locations, right? Mm-hmm. And certainly urban locations allow for those sort of gathering spots. But no, I don't think it's limited because it really, a lot of my work, I guess, is looking at our imaginings of what America is, what the U.S. Mm-hmm. condition is, and that happens everywhere, right? And so I feel like what I have to talk about can be talked about anywhere, really, in the world, because also the sort of global reach of the United States is so profound, right? Mm-hmm. It isn't that these events often happen in urban areas, obviously, like I said, because they sort of have the infrastructure for it. But here's something interesting, actually, that when Robert started performing as Elvis, he started in 88, and he toured extensively through the U.S. and through internationally, right? He was everywhere for a while, especially in the 90s. And then the economics of touring musicians has changed profoundly. Mm. So during, even in the 2004, he does every election year, he does Elvis for Prez. And so he tours. And even in, it's awesome. Even in 2004, he was able to go to a lot of red states. Like, I was looking at the tour dates from that, and only, I would say, like between one third and a half were in, you know, Democratic leaning big cities of the United States, and the rest were in red states. They were generally in bigger cities, but also college towns. I mean, it's like, mm-hmm. and that touring economy continues to change. So now he's touring less and doing, you know, like a West Coast tour because it's hard to get enough money to fund your tour
like
across
keep
the
going.
Midwest.
Yeah.
So, but he's willing to go anywhere, and he doesn't really adopt his shows any differently other than looking at what references he can make to the cities that he's in. But mm-hmm. he's not changing his message necessarily, because I think the key to his success is that he's doing this great music. And so you sort of end up dancing whether or not, you know, regardless of your political affiliation, you can be dancing and singing. And then when you're at a concert, it's fun to sing along. So I might not like U.S. immigration policy, but I might sing along to Viva La Raza because it's fun.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
And I think that's how he's affecting change. But the economics of touring are making it more, what's the word? Separated, I guess, that he is doing more in cities. And that's a shame because I think he can do. And he's amazing at being in the place where nobody wants to listen to him and everybody's looking at him with suspicion, like, who the hell is this
what
guy?
Is happening?
And
yeah.
making that a super fun event.
Yeah.
The work, his band member, Slim Evans, the drummer, told me.
That's such Slim, a good or name been, for a yeah, drummer. I know.
It was either Slim Evans or another good name, Pierre Smith, the guitar player. But one of them told me, like, when they're at a show where there's, you know, 14 people in the audience looking suspicious, Robert will work his ass off to make it the best show ever. Mm-hmm. Right. And so to bring that back to the work that I'm doing, I think it's also transportable like that. And in fact, I think one of our things we should be thinking about in theater right now is how do we do outreach into other communities to engage with them, to hear their voices, but also to share our ideas, because I think we have a very big urban-rural divide in yeah. the U.S. We have this, you know, this polarization along these political lines that is that I think theater could interrupt, mm-hmm. you know, and especially because, you know, like, I mean, I think we need like a new Chautauqua, right? That we need a circuit of interesting people doing interesting things, going into places throughout the nation to have these conversations, that other if groups are doing this. There's a lot of right-wing think tanks that sponsor lectures that go mm-hmm. into, you know, rural areas and stuff. We need to be doing that too, as theater artists who are engaged, not with political issues, but with social justice and with also conversation and collaboration, right? I'm not trying to make this a left-right thing. Like, the lefties have to get out there too. We as theater artists are great at having conversations yeah. and creating dialogue and hearing different voices. And we need to do that for everybody in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I love that. if it would pick up on the audio, I'd be snapping. I am. I'm snapping right now. I don't know. Okay. Using that as a kind of a segue, mm-hmm. as you're talking about the far reaches of the United States, you have done some scholarship on, you recently did a conference about South Pacific
yeah.
as the theme. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to talk about it. You tell me
right.
How that came up, how that sort of Hawaiiana, I don't know if that's mm-hmm. that's a real thing that you could say, Hawaiiana.
Why not? In the academic world, we make up words all the time.
Okay, so awesome. Oh, man, I have to get a PhD. I've been thinking about it. I want a PhD. I want to just start making up words.
Yeah, and you can say made up things with authority.
I mean, like, I'm a doctor. Yeah, Hawaiiana. So you presented with Elvez yes. in San Diego. On sort of, I'm going to go ahead and say the nerd side of some tiki culture topics.
For sure.
Can you get into that with me a little bit?
Yeah. So the event that we were at is called Tiki Oasis. It's been going on for, I don't even know how terrible I should look this up.
1,000 years.
Millions of billions.
This is not an academic podcast. So you can just, make shit up. That's fine.
Well, it's been going on for a really long time mm-hmm. in San Diego. And they take over this this hotel. Like, the Crown Plaza Hotel just becomes the giant tiki conference. And then all the neighboring hotels, people are there. And it's a lot of people. It's amazing. So really, the way it struck me, again, as an outsider, this is my first time there, but the way it struck me was, like, a lot of people who are passionate about tiki culture get to get together and wear fun clothes and drink fun drinks, and there's bands, there's all sorts of stuff going on, there's programming throughout, and so it's really like a big party weekend where you bring your best tiki wear and go. And then, so Elvez, Robert has been involved with that for years. He's played there as Elvez. He's played there with his band, the Little Richards. He's played there with a lot of different groups. And it's just a really fun, and he, you know, he's originally from San Diego. He grew up in Chula Vista. And mm-hmm. so he is, like, there's a bit of a, like, the hometown loves to have him involved, and he likes to be involved in these
Very
things.
Cool.
So he's like the hometown boy, right? But yeah, so he's a big part of it. And then he put in this year to do a seminar, and they're trying to, I guess, program in a few more of these slightly meatier options of a little more thought, and not just here's how to make a really great Singapore sling,
right?
But a little more like, let's engage with this a bit more. And so he put in to do a seminar, and then he asked me to be a part of it. And so the theme of the Tiki Oasis this year was South Seas cinema. And we specifically looked at South Pacific and just focused on that. And so we did a panel discussion, and it was modeling an academic conference panel, right? So, but also departing from it. So Elvez was the moderator, and he sort of asked all the questions and led everything. And then it was me, two musicians. They're in a group called Pony Death Ride. Joe and Jay. Yeah, right. And they do like kind of funny lyrics to different songs, and they're they'll play like a ukulele and a little glockenspiel and stuff like that. So they're really great. So it was Joe and Jay from Pony Death Ride, and then Paul Minton, who plays keyboard he plays with Elvez sometimes and is in a bunch of San Diego bands. And he is Korean American. And an incredible musician. So he was there to both play piano underneath things, but also give, as Elvez introduced us, he's going to represent all Asians everywhere.
Right. Good.
Yeah. So it was like this mock academic panel, except for the academic insights that I were adding were real, right? But right. We sort of played up the performativity of it. I was the professor. Like, he'd only refer to me after he introduced me. He gave me a real introduction, but then it was the professor. Let's ask the professor. And then I used like all the biggest words I could pull out.
Nice.
But also really talked about real academic issues and dramaturgical interventions, really, because what we did with this. So I read quite a bit. I read the original Mishner book. Read several
that's
articles.
It's called Hawaii, right?
What is it called? It's South Seas, Stories from the South Pacific. That's what it's called.
He wrote lots of stuff about this. Yeah. What I don't know can fill a warehouse. I think that's going to be the tagline of this podcast, actually. I think it's the second time I've said it on air.
Okay. Well, I had never read it before. I just learned that. I didn't even know that it was, like, I didn't know any of this, right, until I started doing research for this. So I read the Mishner book, which is very, you know, I don't know if you've ever read any Mishner. This was my first time reading him, but it's very, it has an objectivity of tone. It's striving more for, I mean, it's fictionalized, but it's informed by his actual experiences as a soldier in the Navy. Or a sailor in the Navy, I guess, in the South Pacific. So it's very accurate, and it has, like I said, this sort of journalistic tone, even as it's spinning these little narratives, right? So I read that. I read about the original musical, and then we watched South Pacific.
South Pacific, the musical, is that based off of the writings of the Mishner book, or do they both? My stars, the things I've learned just now. Okay.
Fantastic. Yeah, Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote it based off the stories. And actually, it was only a few of the stories. And then they developed it into the musical. And then that got adapted into the screenplay. And the same people were involved, but the screenplay made some departures as well. So we were kind of tracking the changes that happened.
My goodness.
Yeah. And which felt very, like, again, felt really dramaturgical of, like, what's this original source? How are these adaptations changing it? How are they interacting with their moment? How is that coming through to now? What does it mean for us to look at it now? So that was kind of the work that I did. The other thing that was really great about it is that, so Robert asked me to be a part of this, and I started doing research, and then I'd, like, text or email before we were together, like just some ideas that I was having. And then the week before Tiki Oasis, we were both in LA and we were hanging out. And so I was talking through my ideas as he was kind of shaping the panel. So I also feel like as a dramaturgical intervention, he had a great sense of what I could bring to it. And that shaped the way that we brought it together. And he had his distinct ideas as well. But I felt like very much in support of, you know, like, it was definitely his thing. Like, his name was attached to it, and it's Elvez presents this pop culture symposium. So it was his show. So it's very much like working with a director, right? Like, it's your thing, and it's you have to guide it. But let me give you all this information that I have, so that we can make it something really deep and rich and meaningful. So a lot of the shape of it was informed by things that I found interesting that then we talk about and he found interesting too and got incorporated into it.
So what did you find in looking at the differences in the years that these same stories were produced? So from the Michener book to the musical to the movie, how much of what was happening in real life at the time was informing the historical narrative?
Yeah, so it was interesting because I do think the Michener book really tries to show how war is, excuse me, is a lot of waiting around and killing time and then these horrific, gruesome events and then back to sitting around and killing time, right? So that's a big thing of his. And it also shows, his book really shows how war can bring out, if you're a good person, it'll bring out something noble in you. And if you're a bad person, it'll bring out the worst in you. So his book is like full of rape. There's so much rape.
I'm
like,
Jesus.
Right? You know, I'm reading it. I'm like, oh my God.
Which it makes sense, but that seems like it would be upsetting to read.
Yes. And well, you know, and actually I should say it's not that they're often raped. It's just that there's always these men lurking around wanting to rape women. And there's a low number of women on the island. So, you know, the rapes are often averted, but it's like, yeah, there's just like rape.
Just sort of as a reminder, like that's around the corner when we're here.
Yeah. Ugh. And so actually in the book, the reason Bally High exists is because they took all the eligible women off of the island and brought them all to Bally High so they wouldn't get raped.
Smart. I like it. Okay.
So that's why it's like this weird utopia, but it's also, you know, of course the men go there and it's hard to get there. Right. But, and only you have to be brought over by, you know, somebody. So it's that, but it's also, so it's like their desire, but it's also was this protective measure against all these women other than the nurses who were on the island. Right.
So this as reductive as you want to be, I haven't seen South Pacific in probably 20 years.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we've got listeners who are completely unfamiliar apart from like knowing some of those songs, or maybe even not, but can you tell me in, at its most basic, what is the story of South Pacific?
So the story of South Pacific is looking at these, enlisted men who are posted in the South Pacific, right? And there's sort of tracks, the main narrative tracks two different couples. So there's Nellie. Oh my God, I don't even have my notes.
Yes. It's okay.
Nellie.
It's fine.
Nellie and Emile. So Nellie is the young nurse. She's from Arkansas, and she joined the Navy to see adventure because she didn't want to like only live her life in Arkansas. And she was like, there was a guy who was ready to marry her there and all this. And she was like, I want to see the world. I want to know what things are. So she's this adventurous young nurse from the Midwest, essentially. And then Emile is this French expatriate who has a plantation on the island, that on one of the islands. I can't remember if they're on one island or several islands. But Emile has this plantation, and then he's sort of suspicious because he's European, and what are you, and why are you here, and what happened? And then it turns out he killed somebody in his past, but it's for a good reason, you know.
Okay.
It's fine. It works out.
It's fine.
And there's actually a greater complication, which I'll return to, right? But then there is the lieutenant, and I'm totally blanking on his name.
It's fine. You could just say the lieutenant.
The lieutenant, I think his name, I think he's a lieutenant. I don't know. Anyways, he's like
the war
the
guy.
Handsome young American, right? He was from Yale or Philadelphia or something. Like, he's this like sophisticated, handsome young man. And then he falls in love with Bloody Mary's daughter. And Bloody Mary is this Tonkinese woman who's a mercenary who just profits off these soldiers being there and does all this trade. And then she sets him up to be with his daughter. So one of the big issues, so these are both stories from the book, but when they were making it into the play, they were like, oh, well, we love this love story between them, but he's going to marry this. He's in love with this woman of color We can't have that, right? Like that's
What year was the musical versus the book ish?
the book was, oh my God, I should
I'm
have reviewed my
sorry.
notes before this, right?
Dr.
Because I have all
Martinson, this is your
this.
dramaturgy of the South Seas quiz,
Yeah,
pop
right.
quiz.
So the, let me see.
Circuit
Okay,
dates are
I do have
totally
this
good.
written
I
down.
know old timey,
Yeah.
like mid-century.
The book would be, I think the book was 47.
Okay.
The musical, I think, was 49. Like it was pretty
Okay.
close.
So was
And
the
then after, so the musical was incredibly successful. It was like literally among the Hamilton-esque of its day because it toured around for a decade. And then after it was closing down, they made the movie. So the movie came out in the late 50s.
Oh, that's a big gap. So
Yeah.
with the not wanting to have the presenting the well finding the relationship between the GI and the woman of color
Yeah.
problematic, was that a difference in a visual representation versus a written representation? Because it doesn't sound like it was a problem in the Mishner book. Like he was able to just like write that story.
Right. He well, so in both in all of them, the handsome lieutenant dies.
Okay.
And that's sort of like it's sort of like, well, that solves that problem because you can be in love with this woman of color, but you can't
Right,
marry
but you
her,
can't just
right?
like get married and start a
Yeah.
family. What are you going
And in
to
fact, he has that problem. Like he's like, I can't be with you because I'm this, like rich white
Because
guy
I'm
who's got to
white
go
and
back and married
handsome.
a white woman,
Yeah.
and I can't do this even though I love you, right? So that comes up in all of them. And the solution to it is kill him.
Great,
It's
super.
really
Well, I like that
easy.
more than kill her, which seems
Yeah.
like the way that it usually goes, but
Yeah. Right,
I don't
right.
know if
Well,
I
and what they
like it more. It
said,
doesn't sound like the right way to put it, but you know.
right.
It
It seems less awful.
seems less problematic,
Right. But maybe not.
but not unproblematic.
So when they were writing the musical, they didn't want to make that the sole focus because they said we're going to have the Madame Butterfly problem, right? That it falls into that, and they didn't want to repeat that trope. So their solution wasn't to, have him be able to say, no, I will marry you or something like that. No. The solution was to bring in Nellie and Emile. So they become the counterpoint. And so they really are engaging with race in the musical and in the film less so. And this was really interesting because they, Rodgers and Hammerstein, were Jewish. And this was during the musical was coming out during the HUAC trials, right? The House Un-American Activities Committee trials. And Jewishness was associated with communism at that time. Like, if you were a Jew, you were a commie, right? Was sort of like the understanding.
Okay, that's
In
yeah.
fact, some senator that I read this in one of the articles that I read actually talked about Stalin, and it's like, well, and we know he has some commie Jew wife. Like literally, like you're like, oh, okay,
Oh,
wow,
well,
that's
that's
interesting.
okay. So just drawn a straight line between the two
Yeah.
things.
Yeah.
Okay.
So part of their so they were invested in civil rights, and the civil rights movement is kicking off to a certain extent. It's not in full blown yet, but they were invested in that, and in part their investment with civil rights issues and striving for racial equality was a way to avoid seeming communist, right? Because they could say, no, we're
This is the
American.
most
We
American
are,
thing I could do right
yeah,
now.
the most American thing would be to fight for this, and that proves to me that I'm not a commie. And also the commies are coming, this was the great fear, is that communism would attract all these, people who have been oppressed by capitalism and welcome them into it. So, if we fight for racial justice, we're actually fighting against communism, right? Because if African Americans have access to equal rights in capitalism, they will obviously choose that over communism, right? So it was a double thing. So,
Wow, I had no idea they were like such early social justice
yeah.
warriors.
It's interesting because they really did, and they, the producers were like, maybe ease up on that, and they were like, no, this is the most important part of
Yeah.
this of what we're doing here. So they really did strive for that, but at the same time, they are victims of their own era of racial bias, right? So one of the things they do is with the woman of color, she doesn't speak. they make her mute, which in the book, she speaks French and her native language. And
what?
Yeah. She's, and they have like it is clearly a it starts as a sexual relationship, as of like love at first sight, but then also they have sex in the book. Mm-hmm. And, but then they spend all this time talking and getting to know each other. In the musical and the movie, she's mute. And, so, I mean, that's a, it's like, he's going to die, but they already killed her, because if you can't sing in a musical, you don't exist.
Then you're just like, hey.
Yeah. You're just there to be like, you know, I can tell
a little bit. Yeah.
So that shows their racial bias. There's other things in it, you know, that now we look at it and it's like, seems incredibly offensive, you know. In fact, right. So the other story, the Emil and Nelly story, her thing is she finds out that he was married to a Tonkinese woman. And he had taken other lovers. He was married to this woman, and then he has these children who are mixed race, and she can't get over it. And she's going to break up with him because she cannot get over the fact that he was with, it's not even in the book. It's not even person of color. It's like the N-word, right? She's like, I could get the, you know, a Chinese woman is fine because they have that exotic appeal. But this Tonkinese, which is like Vietnam, I guess, this Tonkinese is basically a N-word, right? And it's like, really,
damn.
Right there.
Okay.
Yeah. Damn. Like, I'm like, like, this is a word I don't like finding in my literature, right?
Right. But,
and then, you know, so she's like, I can't handle that. That's awful. I can't deal with it. And then she ultimately overcomes that. And that's actually the song, You've Got to Be Carefully Taught. Or You've Got to Be Taught. It's I just gave the Lin-Manuel shout out, right? But it is about how racial prejudice is taught. And so they're using that to, like I said, engage with these civil rights issues. But they're very, like, the song itself is like, you know, even if your eyes are oddly shaped, you're still a person, you know? And so it's like, there's this embedded racism as they're fighting racism.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, the way she overcomes it, he's European, so the woman he was married to is dead. So like that solves that problem. And then he has these mixed race children who are lovely and they come out and sing these cute French songs and teach her French and stuff. But they're sort of like, you know, one article I read described them as like, well, they're not so bad because she can adopt them like they would, like she would a fuzzy kitten, you know? So it's like, these racial politics are really weird, right? Like they're trying to do this racial, this have this civil rights narrative, and they really do, you know, I mean, some of it is, you know, prejudice is taught, we have to learn to overcome this. This is what we need to do. But even in the evoking of it, it's sort of like weirdly racist as they do.
Yeah. I used to work in the education department at Ford's Theater. So that was teaching both theater and a lot of Civil War social studies. And, you know, I was always struck by what strikes me now as the racism in Abraham Lincoln's early writings and speeches.
For sure.
And like that was, I mean, he was so progressive at the time that South Carolina started a war about it.
Yeah, right.
They thought it was too much of a pinko, basically.
Yeah.
And so it is this dicey, fascinating tension about looking at sort of how iterative and slow that march towards justice needs to be.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Right. It's so slow. And then I think just to add to this, then in the movie, it's even weirder because like you have the Bloody Mary figure who's she's like this empress on Belly High, but she's also this mercenary, and she's sort of treated as this disgusting thing, you know, by the Americans. And there's actually a line that I do have written down, so I'm going to quote it. She comes up and says something to the lieutenant, and he's like, "Who's she?" And the guy goes, "Nobody. She's Tonkinese." But this woman plays this horrible. I mean, it's just this. You know, she seems just crude and you know, it's just the worst stereotype, and this woman has to play it, and it's really painful to watch because you go, oh god, what would that be to be the actor having to be like, oh, you so sexy, you know? I mean, it's just that level of Curtis, and they give her a little bit of redemption when they get to Bally High because she's like an empress and she's like, welcome, this is where I am. And her voice changes a little bit in that. So it does suggest that maybe she's performing for the Marines, but not enough, right? And then you're watching that and it's, you know, in trying to film. And then I think with the filmic version too, it's like, I mean, it was using all these really advanced techniques of filmmaking that I don't know or understand, but
sure.
But it's beautiful and it's got these weird, it uses these weird color filters and all these things, but it's gorgeous for the most part. And it just adds to the idea that, and I think this was intentional by the movie, because by the time the movie comes out, it's like tourism is opening up quite a bit. And there was this understanding that whereas in Europe and in Northern Africa, like, we were part of the Allied forces, like, America won the Pacific, right? This is ours to conquer. And now it's ours to feast on in consumption. So, like, the whole Bally High, when they go there, is like this buffet of just exoticism that you might just sample. Like, let's enjoy this. And it really, you know, sort of mimics, you know, what a hula dance might be when you have gone to Hawaii or things, you know, like, this is what you can expect when you're traveling through the South Pacific, and this is yours for the taking.
Right. And okay. I was hoping you'd say exoticism.
I can't get away without saying exoticism.
How much, in your opinion, of modern, Hawaiian tourism is sort of like, I don't know if the word is like recursive or self-reflective, but I love being there. I've been twice. I went on my honeymoon, just like most people do. Mm-hmm. And so much of it almost seems like it is Hawaii doing its best impression of a 1940s idea of old-timey Hawaii.
Yeah.
So with things like South Pacific, how much does that influence then the actual culture that it's sort of appropriating?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the answer is I have no idea.
Cool.
But, I mean, I think at the time, like I said, as tourism is ramping up, these were obviously, you know, mainland hotels, chains and stuff that were marketing to a mainland audience. And so they would, you know, I think they were very much like putting up that performance of itself. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, let's do this and let's offer this because people are ready for that. And I don't know that they cared about authenticity at all. I think, I don't know. I really don't know enough about this to be talking, but I'm, you know, fancy doctor to do this.
Yeah.
I think there has been a lot of work, by the indigenous people of Hawaii to say, we're going to, you know, we need to be in control of this
more recently.
Yeah. So, and there are, you know, I worked with a woman in LA, actually. She was a hula dancer and taught hula classes. And her whole point was to bring it back to the original intent of the hula performance, which is nothing like,
it's not just, you like know,
the ladies in the bikini tops, right?
Yeah.
It's not that, even though obviously some of the dance moves are similar, but it has a much more important community function and cultural function. And she was invested in bringing that back to reclaim that. And I think that work has been going on, but I would imagine at the 50s, it was the hoteliers who had money could set up these ceremonies, you know?
Yeah, it's whatever my imagination wants it to be.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, like, you see that. And in fact, I think that's a part of the reason why we got such a good turnout at this event in the first place, is that there is also within this is coming from what Robert has told me, within the tiki community, especially among younger people in the tiki community, because it's a big, you know, I mean, there's mm-hmm. old,
there's a wide spot.
I mean, it's the wide range mm-hmm. of age, right? That there are people who are like, you know, if we're just showing up to dress up and play fun, we should be, you know, like, that's appropriation and we should be thinking about that. So we should use this to do some,
let's educate ourselves.
Self-reflection. Yeah. Honestly. So I think, it's a movement within the tiki culture now. It's a movement within, obviously the indigenous cultures is saying, we'll tell our stories. Thank you.
So when you go to these big events, what is, racially sort of the demographic, breakdown? Yeah. Is there a big diversity in, different backgrounds as well as different ages, or is it a lot of white people?
It's a lot of white people. I would say very diverse ages. Because it's in San Diego, there was a fair amount of Latinx folks there. I think, well, I shouldn't say because it's in San Diego, but I'm sure that partly informs it because that's easy, you know, like there's a lot of Latinx folks in San Diego.
And that's actually something I was wondering about too, because most of my tikiing has been Southern California based, because that's where I live. And I like, so it looks to me like from what I've seen that it is a white and Latinx kind of cultural celebration of the Pacific Islands.
Yeah.
But I don't know, is that.
Yeah, what it no, looks and like? I know one of the women who's involved with like the steering committee, I don't even know her actual name, but her tiki name is Cat Wings, right? But she's a Asian American and is really working to bring in a lot more diversity and a lot more intellectual rigor to it. So she's among those who are like, we need to not just show up and wear our funny clothes, but really, I shouldn't say funny, but you know what I mean? Wear our fancy clothes. But we need to be thinking about these things. And so I think she is, and again, I don't know that much about it, but I think she is one of the people who are trying to make it a more diverse event, right? But my impression, my general impression was a lot of white people and Latinx folks.
Okay, cool. I mean, not cool that it's not more diverse, but cool that you have that knowledge and I'm not hallucinating when I look at the crowds.
Well, and I think there's also an overlap with rockabilly culture, and I know that is very white and very Latinx as well.
Yes, and at least in LA, also with like muscle car, fancy old timey car culture, which tends to be, I think, Mexican American specific.
Yeah.
And oh man, everybody's got such good tattoos.
I know. I know. Like I have tattoo envy and like hairstyling envy. The like you said, the rollers. Like I'm like, oh, wouldn't that be
I wish I could
know how to do that.
Do it. Yeah. I wonder if there's a way to get so good at it that it doesn't take up your like the first 6 hours of your day.
Right.
Like once you've practiced.
Although I think there was a woman at our seminar that had her curlers in her hair. I mean, she made them also look really cute, you know, like she looked like, I'm a 50s house. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, I think, you know, there might not be a way to speed it up that much.
Yeah.
To do it correctly. Right.
Yeah. And that's something that's very interesting to me about this whole, as a cultural / pop cultural phenomenon, you know, looking at it through this lens of gender, like that look is so cool. And in some ways it seems like it would be very, empowering and liberating and all the things to be able to just go out in public as what, you know, the truest expression of yourself.
Right.
But there's something very repressive about having to put that much front end work into being able to go be a woman and exist in public, which was true, you know, in the mid century to get yourself gussied up, to go look presentable, to go out to dinner. But for us, you know, I say us like, tiki inclined women, I guess, to intentionally put that back upon ourselves so that we can be part of this community is funny.
Yeah. There's a scholar, her name's Caitlin Rieger, and she does burlesque. She writes on burlesque, and she also is a burlesque performer. But I read, it was part of her dissertation, but it was a conference paper, and she actually talked about this because there's a big, you know, feminist move. Like there's it's a hugely feminist group now doing burlesque, for the neo burlesque. It's like ownership of our body, and you know, you know, this is about my expression of my sexuality, not for anybody else, and these kind of things. And one of the points she raised is if you look at the legends of burlesque, and they're actually a group of women that are known as the legends. Like they come in every year and do a performance, which is amazing because they're just early burlesque for performers. But feminists didn't like them when they were performing because they were doing this male thing, you know, regardless of what they were, you know, the feminists. So there's a little bit of a, you know, it's ironic, first of all, that these young women are saying, yeah, we're feminists. And that's why we do burlesque, because they're going, ooh, the feminists were awful to us. Right.
Interesting.
And then there's also, you know, I mean, many of the legends talk very specifically. It was the best way for them to make money.
Yeah.
So, it wasn't about self-expression. Not that they didn't, you know, like they may have enjoyed the dance or whatever, but like, it was also like
I'm
a money
small
making
business
endeavor.
Owner. Yeah.
Yeah.
My last podcast guest, and this episode none of the episodes are up yet. So nobody has any point of reference, but I talked to Natalie Van about the dramaturgy of burlesque, and she's a burlesque performer. Natalie Van is my cousin. Natalie Valentine is the burlesque. Hi, Natalie's.
Hi, Natalie.
As far as I know, my cousin doesn't do any burlesque, but maybe.
Yeah, right.
Natalie Valentine is fairly new to that scene, but that's what she. One of the things that she mentioned that I thought was so interesting, and it reminds me, as theater people, of Gypsy. And that drive to go be a successful burlesque lady, because you know there's no male breadwinner in the house, and like what can you do, you need to pay your bills, what can you do? Okay, sorry, I did not want me to derail, but
no, it's great. Well, and actually one of my favorite of the legends that I saw was she goes by Viva La Fiva. And she was in San Francisco, so she's working on a burlesque performer, but she also became a union leader and became one of the first women to drive a forklift and do these things. Like, she really broke all these barriers within a labor union and became a union leader. So it was interesting because she's kind of the tail end of these legends, right? Mm-hmm. But using the skills of burlesque to also make her way through the union. But kind of before that, that wouldn't have been open to them, right? Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be able to join that union. It was because of, so it's really interesting how I think the foundation of feminism maybe was sprinkled along the way, but for those early performers, no, they were definitely were about supporting themselves and making a living and doing it in a way that allowed them to, you know, I mean, there's tons of benefits. They got to travel the world in some cases, mm-hmm. but it was not primarily, this is an expression in defiance of the patriarchal gaze.
It's right? Like, somebody pay me.
Right.
Yeah. Love it. So to start wrapping it, what do you have next on your professional / pop cultural horizon?
So what I'm doing next is actually preparing for an academic conference. Not the exciting, fun conference of Tiki Oasis, but the academic conference. American Society for Theater Research. And I'm going to be writing about Elvez, and I'm really going to be talking about, this is going to be a chapter in the book, but I'm looking at how he engages with the audience, not requiring empathy, but actually haven't really thought through this paper. But like, it's not an empathetic, I like him because he's just like me, the way we often empathize with characters. I feel for that character, right? Mm-hmm. He's not using empathy as a mode of audience engagement. He's actually using irony. And there's this gap between himself as this character and his relationship, you know, Robert as the performer and Elvez as the relationship, as the character. And then that carries through in the way that he's asking us to engage with him. Like, he's gives us plenty of cues that what he's saying is totally inauthentic. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause he's this ridiculous, I mean, like, he wears these crazy, beautiful costumes of, you know, sequin bell bottoms and you know, it's everything's over the top, so it's like you can't really, you're getting these clues that this is a performance, but then he's talking very persuasively about things and telling his life story, but then there's cues in there that that life story that he's telling you is not true, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I was born on Christmas Eve and my mother told me I would be the best Elvez that ever did, you know what I mean? Like, that didn't really happen, right? So you're getting this information, but then at the same time, he actually tells a lot of truth on the stage. Like, he's often saying not just political truth, but he'll say things from his actual life. So I'm looking at that. I've dabbled in this before, so I'm coming back to it to really engage, but looking at how this might be an effective mode for us who do theater and social change, because we rely on empathy. And sometimes empathy can work to say, oh, I feel so bad for that person. And because I felt these strong feelings. Now I feel like I've done something and then I go home. Right.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm kind of working through with that.
I'm interested too in, now that I'm in LA, I spend a lot of time in comedy theaters. And I'm more in that scene than in the traditional theater scene these days.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the best, mainstream counterpart for that would probably be, it sounds like Stephen Colbert's previous persona on Comedy Central. And I think there's starting to be conversation among other smart dramaturgs I know about starting to have a refreshed look at, you know, late night comedians and their use as a political instigator, like taking sort of the real old timey theatrical roles for like galvanizing people and their opinions and doing it with a little bit of distance so it doesn't feel like it sucks so much.
Right. Yeah, totally. And yeah, it's like situating it, you know. I mean, Robert uses a lot of, you know, sort of, I mean, like I said, it's rock performance, so it's a different thing, which I think is really useful, but you know, he's super aware of different vaudeville performers and things and bringing that to the performance so that it is entertaining but also thoughtful, and it gets us away from it doesn't suck.
Even though it sucks. So much sucks right now.
But also, I mean, but I think there's something, you know, in his shows you have a great time, right? Like you're dancing and singing, and that is also really important, right?
Yeah.
That we remember, you know, there's an activist that I just learned about, and everybody should know about her. She's in LA. Her name is Shamel Bell. She's an activist and a PhD candidate, but she does street dance activism is what she calls it. And she was one of the original members of what became Black Lives Matter LA. It was called something else at first, but they then eventually joined. But she, you know, they've been at these big protests and like doing sit-ins at the LAPD and doing events like that. And she teaches everybody dance moves and they do coordinated dances. And it's about the joy of being together and the community, and that that is resiliency and protest. And then she said, you know, similar thing. It's like she said, she spoke at the Association for Theater and Higher Education conference that just happened in Boston. So she was at ATHA as one of the plenary speakers. Mm-hmm. And she talked about how the very same people who were walking by the day before going, you know, get a job, screw you, you know, whatever, don't be criminal, whatever terrible things they were saying, then walked by and saw them dancing. And it was like, can I learn this move? Can I be a part of this? And they said, yeah, come on in. Let's do this. Right.
Oh, man. And like, there'd be such an instinct to be like, no, fuck off. You were
a second ago. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. That's what makes her a better person than I
know. This is why I'm a terrible, like, political community member. Cause they're just like, no, I remember you from earlier.
Yeah. Right. And I think there's something similar with the Elvez shows, right? That you are dancing and having fun. And that is really important for those who feel that they are fighting something, but also it's a way of welcoming others and engaging with others and to seeing community differently, you know? And I feel like his shows do this work of giving us a glimpse of what a nice, inclusive society might look and feel like, and it could be really fun, you know, and that's sort of the power of it.
I love that. I think that's a great spot to wrap, even though there's so much more I want to ask you about. But you know, we got to keep these podcasts to like an LA commutable length. Yeah.
Not 8 hours of podcasting.
So if people want to find out more about your work, where should they go? Where do you live?
I barely live on the internet anymore.
Cool. Where do you live on the Amazon book shopping cart section?
Yeah, I don't have that yet either. I'm working on that. Right? I am on Facebook that I barely ever use anymore, but people can certainly contact me through that. It's Karen Jean Martinson. I'm on Instagram, which is just random pictures of neat things in my neighborhood. That's at Miss Karen Jean.
I'm gonna follow
and
you
I'll
on
give my
Instagram.
school address, because then when I leave, if somebody's annoying me, I can just get rid of it,
Yeah,
right? But
get out of here, guys.
my email address at Chicago State is kmartins, kmartins, at csu.edu.
You guys got csu.edu? You guys
Yeah, we
swooped
did,
right
right?
in there.
Yeah, apparently California State was asleep at the wheel.
I know. I'm a Cal State Long Beach alum, so
Oh,
like,
awesome.
I feel like I want that email address, but you know.
Right.
Karen Jean Martinson, thank you so much for being on with us today, and I'm excited for you and your new Arizona adventures happening next time. So maybe when you get into
Yeah.
your new position or start getting ready for it, and you want, if you want to come back and tell us
Oh
about
my God.
all the dramaturgical
I would
differences
love that. Also, I
between.
think when I get there, I'll probably have to have a web page, so you know, I'll have more of a presence once I get there.
That's great. Cheeky expert diva. I don't know. It seems like there should be some sort of like a trite moniker that goes with the, like a tiki guru goddess something, but it all also sounds really gross.
Right.
So
Well, and to be fair, you know, this was a deep dive into tiki culture that I hadn't been in before, right?
okay.
But that's what we do as dramaturgs,
I
right?
like
We're
it.
like, I'm going to invest the next bit of this to gain as much expertise as possible. I know
Yeah.
I'm not going to be an expert, but I'm going to do that incredible work of learning everything that I can as quickly as I can. You know, I mean, I think
Yeah.
that that's what it felt like,
Moving
'cause
on.
yeah, and then move on,
I'm
right?
an expert in
In
like
whatever
20
comes
different
next.
things. Yes, to a certain extent. Thank you so much for being on with us today. This is Dr. Karen G. Martinson. She is an expert in many things. She can probably do some production dramaturgy for you if you find yourself in Arizona in the coming year or Chicago in the current year. And she's great. And have a great day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun. I really loved it.
Yay,
Yay!
bye.
Bye.
Okay, and I'm actually back again with Karen on another day because I got an email after our interview. We've got a postscript. So, Karen, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you so much for agreeing to have me back on. I know how much time this is, and I really appreciate the chance to just kind of talk about the issues that I mentioned in email. Do you want me to
Oh,
just launch
sure.
into
Yeah,
it?
go for it.
Yeah, so when we did our initial recording of this, I did not have my notes handy for some reason because I was being a bad scholar or something, but I could not remember the name of the leads, and I felt really stupid about that just because that's bad dramaturgy. But also, and more importantly, I realized so first of all, let me say their names. Lieutenant Joe Cable is the handsome American man who's going to, you know, he's the epitome of what a musical theater lead should be, except for the fact that he falls in love with this native woman, and her name is Liat. And I could not remember her name, and it was really bothering me. And I realized the reason it was bothering me, and I wanted to call this out for myself, is that I was doing the same kind of harm to this character that I accuse Rodgers and Hammerstein of doing, because they render her voiceless. Well, then I rendered her nameless. And also because I kept referring to her as the woman of color. And I was reminded when I was at AFA in Boston, we had a really interesting conversation about this term, women of color, people of color, and how it's meant to be inclusive and it does some important work, right? Because it's saying people who are non-white, and non-white is offensive, right? Because it's centering whiteness, right? But people who are non-white endure oppression by whiteness in ways that white people do not, right? And so it's trying to call up this collective act of oppression that happens in our racist society. But at the same time that it does that, it generalizes everybody and lumps them into this category of people of color. And the of color part is still focused on their bodies. And it's still defining them by their bodies rather than as human beings who are worthy of respect because they are human beings. And there's like reasons behind all that, but at the same time, it's not unproblematic. And it was just a really rich conversation. And then I was like, wow, I just did that. Like, I just defined this character solely by her bodily features, which is endemic to the play itself. But if I'm trying to speak out and be a really good ally and be anti-racist, I need to call that out when I did it. So that's why I wanted to talk to you.
Yes. And for people who are listening who don't know, ATHA is a what is it? Association of Theaters in Higher Education.
In Higher Education, yes.
Awesome. I'm so glad that you did come back with that too, because for the purposes of this podcast, like, it's not academic, so I'm fine with people, you know, What's Her Bucket and that other guy are totally great. But yeah. but in the context of what you're, you know, talking about with your overall message about, you know, this woman being rendered nameless and voiceless, I'm really glad that you wanted to come back on the show. And
well, thank you.
And put a bow on that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And I guess it's just, you know, I think it's a reminder too that this is the way racism and racial oppression persists, right? That if you are raised white in this country, you don't have to think about these things in the same way. And our privilege protects us and it makes us blind to a lot of things. And if we want to be committed to a struggle to dismantle racism, we have to acknowledge when we screw up. And we're going to screw up because we're effectively trained and programmed by white supremacy to be white supremacists, even if we don't want to be that, right?
Yeah, I feel that.
Yeah, so we have to call it out and just be like, oops, I totally screwed that up. And I want to own that and say, let's not screw it up. And, you know, please accept my apologies for having done that. But also let me not, you know, sometimes, and I guess that in 2 weeks, we've had so much happen on the political front too. And I'm just like,
true.
Yeah. And I'm like, I don't want to be like, oh, but I didn't mean it, you know? And that's okay because we're hearing that right now.
Right.
The Supreme Court nominee and all this crap, you know? So it's like, we just have to own it. And we have to say, you know what? I screwed up and I'm going to screw up because racism and racial oppression wants me to screw up. And when I do, I need to own it and say, that is wrong. And that's how we'll get better, I guess, as a nation. So,
yeah, I'm fully on board with that, especially for this podcast. I mean, the episodes haven't been released yet, but one of the last ones I recorded was with my friend Bernardo, who's an LMDA person.
Yeah.
And it's about the like Spanish English code switching.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I'm keeping all of my terrible pronunciations in and like being a Southern California person who didn't ever learn Spanish in a meaningful way. And it's just, if you guys haven't listened to that episode yet, it's just me fucking up. And Bernardo saying smart things and then just me stepping in it and being aware that I'm stepping in it.
Yeah.
And like trying to fix it. So I think that, I don't want to say failing publicly, but like sort of failing forward as we're trying to work towards, the world we want to see and not pretending like, oh yeah, no, I came out of the womb enlightened and I've just continued to be the exact level of person that I want to be the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. Right. well, and I think, yeah, I mean, like we will fail and it's, our failures don't make us any less committed to the fight, but if we try to ignore them or absolve them, then we're asserting that privilege, right?
Yeah.
Like we're going to mess up. So let's do it. That's fine.
Yeah.
like I said, let's own it and say, this is, you know, I did this wrong. So, I don't want to do it wrong. And the way to improve is by calling it out and correcting.
Yeah. Let's look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that.
And I'm glad. Yeah. Thank you, really, because I would have just been, it would have been at the back of my mind gnawing away at me forever, right? But also, I think, you know, since this podcast is geared for non-academics, sometimes I think what we talk about as academics, the way it filters through to the general public seems stupid and out of touch, or, you know, like it seems somehow unrelated. And to me, this very instance is like, no, this is why it's important. This is why it's related. And this is what we try to do in the academy. And I appreciate outlets like this that make it, that serve as that bridge, you know. And I mean, I say, that's dramaturgy, right? The eternal metaphor for dramaturgy is bridge building. But that we do need to be connected. We need to connect these conversations to the general public. And so I appreciate also being able to share a little bit of this discussion we had at AFA and why it's important for us to be thinking about, not just at AFA, but in the world.
Yeah, cool. Karen, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
And keep being awesome. I think that's what I'm going to go with. Keep being awesome.
Thank you. I'm going to try.
All right. Awesome.